Over the past several months, we watched the destructive eruption of Kilauea claim some 700 structures, displacing whole communities. The lava activity has also opened the doors to research never before collected with the help of drones and undersea robotics. We talked to USGS volcanologist Wes Thielen about what seems to be a pause in the lava eruption and what may come next.
For a matter of weeks now, we have not had really any significant flow of lava down in the Lower East Rift, and the collapse in the summit has basically stopped. So it's very quiet up around the volcano right now.
And so there's nothing then going in the water?
So I did not look to see what the last overflight saw, but there was some dregs of lava that were draining out of various pieces in the lower part of the flow there that were still making it into the water the last time I checked. But that's sort of expected. That's not coming from the Fissure 8 vent. That's just coming from sort of just the stored magma that's in the that was in the tube system once the eruption sort of stopped.
And there's no real way of knowing what's going on.
I mean, I guess that's one way that you could put it. I guess the way that I would prefer to think about it is that we've got a situation where, you know, we certainly have some amount of hot magma that's still under the Lower East Rift Zone. And again, like we've done various times in this eruption, we can look to previous activity at this volcano and around the world. And what we find is that, you know, pauses in eruptions are fairly common. So one, you know, there's one outcome to this, which is that the eruption is over. And that's one possibility. The other possibility is that we could be in a pause. And we did see pauses in 1955 and 1960 down in the Lower East Rift. And a resumption of activity after that. And so we are constantly monitoring the volcano as far as either inflation or deflation goes, and whether or not there are earthquakes or changes in earthquakes or the types of earthquakes. So we're certainly monitoring the volcano and looking at the pulse of the volcano and trying to figure out whether or not we are within a pause or whether the eruption is over. And what we're, you know, the evidence based on our instruments is not definitive. So we don't know definitively whether or not we're in a pause or whether or not the eruption is completely over.
Well, even a pause would be welcome at this point.
Yeah, I mean, there are some conflicting pieces of evidence. So we have much lower rates of earthquakes. We have no inflation, so those are two lines of evidence that might suggest that things are pretty much over. But down in the Lower East Rift, we still see the certain fissures still have their temperature rising. So like Fissure 10 was reported to have a rise in temperature after the Fissure 8 eruption ended. There may be, and there's certainly anecdotal evidence from residents down in Leilani Estates that cracks are still forming and or extending. So there's still some evidence of activity down there in the Lower East Rift down around Leilani, but there's no lava that's coming out on the surface.
And talk about the earthquakes for a second, because we saw some pretty intense stuff for a while.
Yeah, so the earthquakes really dramatically ended at the summit, and we got in, you know, there was a situation there where we were seeing an earthquake with the equivalent energy release of a magnitude 5 every single day up there. And then all of a sudden in early August it stopped, and not only did the big one stop, but the little one stopped too. So if you remember, the big one was the one that was being felt more widely, but if you were close, the communities of Volcano and the golf course area, they were feeling the smaller earthquakes that were happening between these. And the small earthquake stopped and the large earthquake stopped. And now it's very, very quiet up in the summit area.
Okay. And then what about just the research? Talk about what you folks have been able to glean. Because you folks have had, you know, robots in the water. You've had drones up in the air collecting all kinds of really interesting basic data. But never to this magnitude, I guess, and for this length of time.
That's right. When the eruption started, we learned a lot about the magmatic system and how magma moves from the summit down to the lower East Rift. And throughout the eruption, we learned a lot about that. And as the eruption stops, we actually learn things about the magma system as well. So the speed at which the earthquake stopped and, you know, the Fisher 8 eruption down in the lower East Rift stopped rather dramatically. And the timing of those is really interesting from a scientific standpoint and gives us information that informs our model of how magma moves through the system and what the volcano looks like under there. And as we go through this either pause or as the volcano, let's assume for the sake of this conversation that or this argument that it's done, the way that the volcano would recharge is going to teach us a lot about how magma moves under the crust. And that's all that information is stuff that we couldn't glean in the continuous eruption that was going on from 2008 until 2018. We needed the system to change in a way that was giving us some different clues than it had given us between 2008 and 2018. So there's lots of different things, lots of different vectors that people are going on to figure out what's going on in different parts of the magma system. And that's, you know, that's our goal, is to be able to generate even just a conceptual model, a model in our head, a cartoon that we can use to better interpret a change in activity, earthquakes or inflation or deflation, interpret those in a way that can allow us to assess whether or not the volcano is in a hazardous state or not hazardous state. And the better our model is, that cartoon in our head, or even if we get into the numeric modeling, the better that model is, the better that we can assess whether or not the volcano is moving toward an eruption or not moving toward an eruption.
And you folks have had really a front row seat to this incredible experience. What's maybe the one thing that struck you with this latest phase?
I think the thing that has struck me when I was out there on the ground in Hawaii was just the human element. Being down in Leilani and seeing the just sheer volume of material that was coming out really left me in awe. But then looking around and seeing the destruction and the disturbance to people's lives and the juxtaposition of those two things was really pretty striking for me. From a scientific standpoint, having eruptions go on at the very, you know, tip as far as the island goes of the rift zone and up at the summit together was really a unique opportunity for us to understand more about the volcano.
Right, so while you're in awe of the power of this event, there's also the human toll that it's taken on the lives and that whole community there and the whole loss of the recreational area for that side of the island.
Yeah, and the hit on the tourist industry that has, you know, really impacted people who maybe their houses weren't directly impacted, but their businesses were because they weren't able to, you know, sustain that business through this current sequence when there just wasn't much for tourists to see or to do around the volcano. I mean, it's a tight-knit community in the area, and it feels like everybody knows everybody, and so everybody's touched, even if not directly. They know people, and they're having conversations, and they're sympathetic to the troubles that people are having, either because their houses were directly impacted by the magma or because their lives were impacted by the effects of the volcano.
That was Wes Thielen with the U.S. Geological Survey. He says the research from this latest phase will be formally presented at an upcoming geological conference in December. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In the 1700s, the French launched voyages of discovery and scientific expeditions, voyages for trade, and voyages to protect French religious and political interests in the Pacific. La Pérouse, the French equivalent to England's Captain Cook, spent 2.5 years in the Pacific on a mission to discover new lands, make scientific observations, and establish commercial relations for France. He left France in 1785, and on May 30, 1786, his two ships landed on Maui, making him the first European to set foot on the island. La Pérouse did not, however, claim Maui for France. He writes, "What right have Europeans to land there? Inhabitants have worked with the sweat of their brows, and which for centuries have been the burial place of their ancestors." After leaving Hawaii, he discovered and named this island and these atolls. Do you know the names he gave each of them? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people that you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary and 25 years of support for Hawaii Public Radio. Committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, ferrarochoi.com.
Hurricane Lane only recently departed the Hawaiian Islands, but other storms, Hurricane Norman and Olivia, are moving our way. The Conversation producer, Ryan Finnerty, takes a closer look at how storms stand to disrupt all-important ocean shipping industry here in Hawaii. He spoke with Brad Dechter, president of the freight company Dependable Hawaiian Express, as Hurricane Lane moved through the islands.
Normally, they want the ships out to sea where the waves are higher during a storm, but they can't hit anything. And that keeps the crew safer, and that keeps the assets on the shore safer. So they take the boats out to sea, the vessels out to sea, so that they're basically, as long as they're seaworthy and they can beat the waves, so to speak, they're better off at sea. They can't hurt anything.
And so, Brad, what kind of conditions are these ships designed to handle? You mentioned that some of them are being sent out to sea fully loaded with containers. How safe is it for those ships and the cargo and the crew that are out there?
Honestly, I'm not an expert on this, but the Coast Guard and Matson have been doing this for 100 years. Peixia or whoever Matson's previous rivals were had a long track record. I think that they all agree they're safer out at sea. Now, I know that the waves, they were talking about 42-foot waves out there. And these vessels can absolutely handle those size waves. You know, they've got built-in stabilizers. They've got ways of stabilizing the vessel so that when the waves come, the vessel can handle it. And, of course, depending on which way the waves come, the vessels position themselves so they're not broadsided.
And this is a pretty regular occurrence, I would think, for people in your line of work. Storms happen all year long, depending on which hemisphere you look at. Is this just a matter of routine business?
Well, I wouldn't call it routine. There's nothing routine about a hurricane or a typhoon. You know, when we ship into Guam, and Guam gets more than their fair share of typhoons, and we have to deal with that a lot more than we do in Hawaii. They just seem to be right in the path in a lot of cases. And we also deal with typhoons that go into China and Hong Kong. And we never get used to it. You can never get used to something that you don't know what the impact's going to be. Typhoons and hurricanes are never business as usual. They're something you don't want. So, you know, people tend to not think about all the negatives. So it's something they keep out of their mind until they're sort of forced to deal with.
And typically, how long is the disruption to business before you get back to normal operating conditions around a storm like this, assuming there's not a devastation at the port?
Okay, well, I don't want to use a Niki as an example, because the island of Kauai was really devastated. And you've seen what happened down in Puerto Rico. I mean, it's been a year and they're still not up to snuff. But based on the storms we've had in Hawaii in the past, other than a Niki, where the threat was there and businesses were closed, etc., it's normally a 2-day to 3-day delay.
And, Brad, should there be a serious impact such as what happened during Hurricane Iniki, do companies like yours get used in the relief effort to resupply a place like Hawaii where you can't truck in things or bring them in on rail, or they need to come by ship? How does the recovery process affect your business?
Well, it really depends. I know that in many instances, FEMA gets involved, and they sort of direct how it goes. And they will work directly with the ocean carriers like Peijin Matson. And we've done some charitable work in the past where we've loaded containers with supplies, et cetera, at no charge. And we've worked with Matson to ship them to charitable organizations that are viable 501c3s. But, you know, each one of those is a separate incident where you have to go to Matson and get their approval. So we've done some things like that in the past. I'm not trying to toot our horn under the circumstances, but we do provide, like, we're chartering half an airplane going into Honolulu, I believe, in about 3 or 4 days. So, of course, if we could, we would fill the other half. And I don't want to profit from anybody's misfortune. Okay, if we never had a disaster, I'd be the happiest guy on the face of the earth. They bring problems.
And so you will switch to the more expensive air option if necessary, if seagoing is not available?
Yeah, well, even if seagoing is available, some supplies need to be shipped immediately. I'm trying to think of when it was, but there was a run on generators in Hawaii way back, a few years back, and we ended up air freighting for a hardware company a lot of generators because they were needed on island then. There are some things you can't wait for. So, of course, what you do is you use the method of transportation that's available that suits your requirements.
And, Brad, you mentioned just a minute ago that you don't have any interest in profiting off a disaster. In Hawaii, as in many other states, there's laws against price gouging during a state of emergency. But you also mentioned that you may have to use a more expensive option to get supplies in, like air cargo. How does the fact that a retailer that's selling generators, to use your example, they're now having to pay more to rush their product in, but they're having to charge the normal price. Does that influence retailers' decision on whether or not to bring in new products as quickly as possible?
I've never seen a retailer that was more concerned about at least in Hawaii, that was more concerned about recovering their costs than they were about taking care of members of the community. Remember, we all live in Hawaii. I don't, but my people live in Hawaii. We work in Hawaii. We're members of the community. We consider ourselves Ohana. So, of course, we don't want to be in a position where anybody ever accuses us of price gouging, and neither do the retailers. They all live on island, too. So in all my dealings with most of the retail people I've ever dealt with, and I deal with a lot, I'm not aware of anybody ever saying to me, you know, I'm going to have to increase my prices to recover costs. It's an emergency. You get it done. Everybody works for a little less. You pull together as a community. You try to get the job done.
That was Brad Dechter talking to the Conversation's Ryan Finnerty about how the shipping industry deals with weather disruptions during hurricane season. According to the Central Pacific Hurricane Center, Hurricane Norman is a Category 3 hurricane, 480 miles east of Hilo. It's currently predicted to pass northeast of the Hawaiian Islands tomorrow.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll learn about a couple of student projects that found their genesis in Nalukai Academy. We'll talk to the student team leads about their projects, how they were influenced by Nalukai, and how they see carrying on the effort after the program. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
The battle over the next Supreme Court justice is playing out as we move into the second day of confirmation hearings. That's the focus of the Reality Check with Honolulu Civil Beat. Nick Gruby's on the line with us from Washington, D.C. Morning, Nick.
Hi, Catherine.
Well, I guess it'd be afternoon in your case. Now, hey, you dug up some really interesting information on our nominee.
Yeah, Brett Kavanaugh has a really long history, as we're finding out. During his confirmation hearing, there are a lot of documents related to his time working as a lawyer and also in previous administrations. But one thing in particular that was fascinating to me and to others from the state of Hawaii was his work on a Supreme Court case that is known there as Rice v. Cayetano. And now that decision is one that involved the Office of Hawaiian Affairs elections and whether those elections could be restricted only to Native Hawaiians. Of course, the Supreme Court ruled 7-2 that no, that was unconstitutional. And Brett Kavanaugh happened to be one of the people who argued in a friend of the court brief that it should be held unconstitutional.
So elaborate. So I know that was a big deal, that case here, and really shook things up. But so what did he write about this?
Well, in the amicus brief, the argument really was whether such a race-based classification system would be a violation of the 15th Amendment, which of course is says that the government cannot prevent a citizen from voting based solely on race, and he took his argument a step further by also writing an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, in which he said that he described this system of elections, saying that Hawaii's naked racial spoils system, after all, makes remedial set-asides in hiring and admissions preferences look almost trivial by comparison. And if Hawaii is permitted to offer extraordinary privileges to residents on the basis of race or ethnic heritage, so will every other state. Now, those are some pretty strong words, and they seem to ring as almost anti-affirmative action, for those who are familiar with some of the arguments that are made against affirmative action.
Right, and I understand that he basically thinks that, as far as Native Hawaiians, that they should be considered in the same class as American Indian tribes.
That's right. The headline on his op-ed was, "Are Hawaiians Indians?" And he argued that Native Hawaiians should not be granted the same classifications as Native American tribes, saying, among other things, that Hawaiians came to the islands from Polynesia. Of course, as we know, Hawaii is a part of Polynesia. Now, U.S. Senator Mazie Hirono is expected to question Kavanaugh today on his views on Native Hawaiians, and in particular this case, Rice v. Cayetano.
Right. So the big question is what happens, and if he gets confirmed, what happens to a lot of our programs here?
Sure. I think that's really the big question, is if there is a case involving Native Hawaiians and or indigenous rights that goes before the Supreme Court, how will Kavanaugh vote? And now I think the concern among some legal scholars and observers is that he will not be sensitive to Native Hawaiian needs or those of other indigenous groups, because his view generally is that we are all one race.
Right, and I know we saw the big push for federal recognition as a way to kind of get around this problem.
Sure, that's right. I mean, I think when you look at the Rice v. Cayetano decision, federal recognition really became the topic du jour in the Native Hawaiian communities, because it sort of said, hey, we need to make sure that we do have this, quote, special relationship with the federal government so that we can do our own self-governance and have our own self-determination on issues that are specific to Native Hawaiians.
Right. And so Hirono, I know, says she plans to vote against Kavanaugh's confirmation, and so does Senator Schatz, Brian Schatz.
That's right. The question is whether they can get any other Republicans to join them to block the confirmation.
Right. Okay. Something to track. Thanks so much, Nick.
All right. Thanks so much, Catherine.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat, today featuring investigative reporter Nick Ruby. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org. Homelessness is a problem challenging all of our counties. Today, HBR's Noe Tanigawa joins us live in the studio with more on the situation on Maui.
Yes. Well, you know, I was wondering if they're coming up with some good ideas on Maui, something that maybe we can use here on Oahu. And I'd like to take you today to visit an amazing homeless shelter and affordable housing complex over there. It's in Wailuku. It's called Kahaleake Ola. They've got about 700 people living in an affordable housing complex there. The structures look like dark wooden townhouses, and they're scattered on this rolling 5-acre area. If anything, Catherine, they look like those dark-colored townhouses that are kind of mauka of the freeway in Kahala. You know, they're beautiful and well-spaced, safe, secure, long-term, affordable rentals. People are happy there. They also have 350 emergency shelter beds in a tidy little compound next door where there are dorms and studios and two bedrooms. Let's head on in there. Joy Rucker was the housing program director for Kahaleake Ola Homeless Resource Centers here. Let's go.
In Honolulu, it's a lot of people who do not want to go into shelters because of what they think it's like, which this place is not like.
This is not like any other shelter. You know, we're fortunate because we have the flexibility of units, and most other shelters don't. Either it's a huge open warehouse space, you have little cubicles, or, you know, it's just beds to beds, mats to mats. But we're a little different. We have a different setup. So you walk in and I feel like, you know, I'm in some permanent housing
middle-class condo.
This complex
area.
Yeah. You know, it's well cared for.
Whose idea was this? Who made this?
So this all came about in about 1986.
That is Monique Yamashita. She's CEO of Kahaleake Ola. Now, she said in 1986, Maui churches got together to feed people. They thought there was that need. And they realized that, heavens, these people need shelter. So it was in 1995 that Kahalaiokeola Central there in Wailuku opened, and the west side one, the Lahaina Shelter, opened in 2004. And they say they get about four or five requests for shelter every single day. Now, here's the interesting thing. In 2017, they served almost 45,000 meals in both those facilities.
Wow.
And that was 10,000 meals less than they served the year before. Why? What happened? It's because people just are not staying in the shelter as long. Yamashita says she's seen amazing changes in the last year.
Our Housing First model started in February of last year, and it's working. I believe it's working. I agree with the model. At first, I was like, oh, I don't know about this, you know, because it's so... It was a huge paradigm shift for homeless agencies or the agencies working for the homeless in that we couldn't do the life skill classes anymore. Now we had to connect them to the community. When before we worked with families for up to 2 years. Now we work to get them housed within 60 to 90 days. Lowering our barriers as a shelter, that was really scary.
Lowering your barriers? What kind of barriers?
Well, we actually put barriers in place that stopped people from coming into shelter. We used to drug test people, so they had to be clean and sober to get into the homeless shelter. And the Housing First model says that's not the best way to help individuals. So a huge paradigm shift.
Uh-huh. So yeah. Now you don't get into the shelter and then do programs to get you ready for housing and kind of get your feet on the ground for 2 years? No. Now you get into housing ASAP in 6 to 9 months at the most, and then you link in with the community-provided services to help you stay there in the community. Wow. That is a big difference, right?
Right, yeah. So if you've got a substance abuse issue, you get help working on that.
Yep. You get into a house, and then you start working on it. Wow. How do you get a house? It's not easy on Maui. This person, Jennifer Magawai, she's the housing specialist for Kahalaiokeola. You got to meet this lady one day, Catherine. She does everything. She does Craigslist. She walks the neighborhood. She chats up landlords. She works with realtors. She said she contacts every single person she knows that has a place at least twice a month just to see how they're doing. How are things going? Is anything opening up? And that's how she connects with the clients whom she also knows individually. And remember, we're talking Maui here. That's where a room costs, a room in a house costs $900. And Magawai says her family's, you know, they've been through a lot even before she sees them.
These people here have a story. They go through things. Nobody's perfect. Nobody is rich. Nobody just takes off. They can go to the bank and go take money. They work hard. They have kids. They have to go work two jobs. Not all people who become homeless and end up in the shelter have a drug addiction. They're not violent. They're not dirty. It's expensive to live here on Maui, and some people are not fortunate, like others that own property, that can take out money out of the bank and say, hey, I want to buy that, or, you know, these people live paycheck to paycheck. We try to encourage them to see that they can increase their income so, you know, they can have a little more. She texted me the next morning and apologized. She said, I'm so sorry, you're right. Standing up to people like her gave her the courage to rent to my clients. Today she has given me 3 units, and it brings joy to me. Honestly, it brings joy. Just the children, like, yay. You know, I tell them, go to your room. Go, you know, I want to make sure that they're housed in a place that they want to be housed, that they will be treated fairly.
Just treated fairly. Imagine that. Magawai says she just hopes landlords and owners will give her clients a chance. But, you know, the question is, why should they when they can make, you know, they can charge maybe $1,500 a month for a rental, an affordable rental for a family, or they can maybe charge $1,000 a week as a vacation rental.
Yeah, that's the rub there, right?
It's tough there on Maui. And when you talk to some of the housing people, they say that there are very likely 5,000, you know, vacation rentals there that are just, like, not really accounted for.
Yeah, but the county is, I know, trying to get a handle on that, and I think they're much farther along than Honolulu is in that regard as far as curbing the vacation rental issue. Mm-hmm. But as far as the homeless, do we know where they're found? What areas of Maui where they're concentrated?
Well, Maui is so different from Honolulu. A lot of them are in Kihei area, in Lahaina, and where they are in central Maui, they're just starting to have more of the sort of urban homeless that we're so used to here on Oahu. For the most part, their large encampments are in the county parks. And, you know, I stood at the edge of one of the parks with a service provider who said, there are 200 people here, and you don't see a tent stake. You don't see anything across this large expanse of a field. I would love to take you on that tour. We've still got to do that. But the homeless coordinator there, David Nakama, said really in the urban scene, it's maybe 20 to 25 people who are just the most visible and seem the most disturbing. You know, coming up, we really have got to talk to Maui's homeless coordinator, David Nakama. And they recently got somebody who has been in the planning department but moved over to be housing director, Will Spence, who has a real commitment to affordable housing. These are two people that we're still going to check in with.
Okay, so we can look forward to those stories in the next week or two?
Yeah.
All right.
They're doing well, and they're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel there on Maui.
Well, bright spots.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Noe Tanigawa giving us a closer look at the housing situation on the Valley Isle.
Aloha, I'm Larry Bartley from Save Oahu's Neighborhoods. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Fresh young duo of Kailua Moon performs on Saturday the 15th in the Atherton Studio. Slot key virtuoso Danny Carvalho and singer-songwriter hula dancer Nani Edgar will delight you with their covers of Hawaiian tunes and their original compositions. Reserve your seats today at hprtickets.org. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Kailua Moon on the 15th, sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
On August 1st, 1785, the French explorer La Perouse and his 220 men left France and headed for Hawaii. Their route led them to round the bottom of South America, Cape Horn, and investigate the Spanish colonial government along the way, as well as to explore the Easter Islands. Although Perouse spent 2.5 years in the Pacific, his mission to discover new lands, make scientific observations, and establish commercial relations for France. On May 30th, 1786, his two ships landed on Maui, but he decided against settling as it was against his moral judgment at the time. He decided to continue his journey on and later set foot on Necker Island and the French frigate's shoals in the same year. Necker Island is best known for its important prehistoric archaeological sites of the Hawaiian culture, and the shoals are the largest atoll in the northwest Hawaiian Islands. La Perouse nearly lost two frigates while attempting to navigate the shoals. And no one got the answer today. No one got it right, so we stumped you on that one. That is today's quiz, and if you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Big changes on a small island. a kupuna care program offered by Arcadia and a group called Napu'uwai that was in place on Lanai for 12 years is ending. That has launched a new relationship with Johns Hopkins University. Napu'uwai's executive director, Kamahana Hokulani Farr, was in Honolulu yesterday and sat down with us to talk about what's in store for the island community.
It is a pilot project with Johns Hopkins from the East Coast, and it's an aging-in-place program. And the Hopkins program, their acronym is CAPABLE, and our acronym is KAPA, K-A-P-A. And I think of the, it's kupuna, aging-in-place. So if you just kind of remember like old-style tapa, the kapa that just kind of creates a cape over the kupuna that we love that kind of honors and protects them. So the KAPA program has a registered nurse. We're using an advanced practice registered nurse, and it uses an occupational therapist and a repair person to go into a person's home. It probably takes no more than 6 months per person to do an evaluation, to look at the activities of daily living, identify any safety concerns. A repair person will make any necessary repairs. And what they have been able, Hopkins, has been able to identify is that there's better medication management, that people are more engaged in community, that people can age in place longer. And that's one of our concerns because both Molokai and Lanai do not have a skilled nursing facility. So commonly either family members have to stop working to take care of a family member, or I think a bigger loss to us is when our kupuna have to leave their island homes, which means they don't, children don't get to see them, they're removed from the community, but you'd have to be in a skilled nursing facility on another island.
That would be hard.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really hard on
I
folks.
Mean, the imagery of, you know, kapa is really a powerful one. Mm-hmm. And when you are away from your family for your ohana, I can see where that could be could pose problems.
Yeah.
So if you can explain what the need is on that island, how many people are we talking about that this program could cover?
Yeah, I know that the island, when I looked at statistics, there are just a little over 3,000 people on Lanai. So it is a pilot program that we want to do on Lanai and Molokai, and we're starting with Lanai because we had a program that just ended there, and I'm sure there's these huge voids. So part when you ask about needs, that's one of our big questions. So we knew when we started our new project year, August 1st, that we would have to do a comprehensive community needs assessment. So that's also what we're preparing to do. I talked to people about our 30, 60, 90-day plans, and our 30-day plan is to write our comprehensive needs assessment. They're going to be different for Lanai than they are Molokai. They're going to be definitely different for people in Kalaupapa. But those are the three areas that we work in. We want to know what people need. And then we would also do the same thing but different in the business community. What services are here? How could we extend what you do? So it might be like a post-discharge. Could we help providers ensure that they have less readmissions in hospitals? Or could we, on Molokai, it's really popular when we do programs within the schools because then we could work with children and families. So it kind of is going to show us what do people need, which is different than what people want. And then you have to align it with our federal grant to make sure that we're using our grant dollars properly. And then from there, we'll have a bigger plan. So KAPA was one of the programs that we identified in our last program year that we wanted to have a little pilot program just to see what the findings would be, if it would make a difference.
So share with our listeners. So basically, this program is federally funded, and it helps who exactly?
Right. So we are funded through the Native Hawaiian Healthcare Improvement Act. So, you know, when people will be like, well, that'll take an act of Congress. Well, we have that. So the Native Hawaiian Healthcare Improvement Act established five Native Hawaiian healthcare systems. They're on five different islands. So we have Molokai and Lanai. And it established a scholarship program, the Native Hawaiian Health Scholarship Program. In my opinion, functions like the workforce arm of those five different centers. And then it has Papa'ololokahi, and Papa'ololokahi is really active with our governing bodies, whether they're state, local, federal partners. And the Native Hawaiian Healthcare Improvement Act was established because Native Hawaiians die sooner than most other folks. There's a number of diseases or illnesses or health conditions that plague Native Hawaiian: obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular. So when we design programs, we try to identify to make sure that we can demonstrate that these programs improve the health of Native Hawaiians. Some people believe that we only want to help Hawaiians, and that's not true. Even though our dollars are for Native Hawaiians, we understand that when we work in communities, that community is built out of all of us, so we do service everyone.
You've got a situation now where you had a long-term relationship with Arcadia mm-hmm. that provided some of the services mm-hmm. in that community. Okay. So there's going to be this, I would imagine, a gap. What do you want the residents of Lanai to know?
Well, it's interesting. I had a meeting recently with the Community Health Center, and trying to what we talked about is to develop a guide for people. If you want this service, you could go to this agency. So maybe if people had a guide that we could publish, the local newspaper is willing to help give us a little ad. So we could do updates. We could do flyers. We could help people understand if you're looking for a specific service where you can go to get that. I'm not aware that something's going to replace Arcadia, although they could, because they hold the license to provide home health services, and that's what ended with us.
Right, you don't have that ability.
Right, no, the license is a lengthy, expensive process, and so the partnership that we had with Arcadia was always one that we worked really well together. So they did the administrative licensing, and we had the staffing and the supplies. So it worked out really well together. But Arcadia could continue to offer the home health services through the end, their license till the end of December.
Okay. And we don't know what they're planning on doing.
No, I'm not aware of their plans.
Okay. So at this point then, what do the residents of Lanai need to know as you folks ramp up to do this needs assessment?
Right. We've had a couple of meetings, small community meetings. What I'd like people to know is that we're committed to the community, that we're not going anywhere, that we do want to network with some of the Native Hawaiian organizations to understand what services and gaps that they have, what's working really well for people, that when they see ads or signs for focus groups or community meetings, if people can either in paper or by calling us or by coming in person, if they would participate so we could get a good assessment of
right,
what
you want
people
feedback.
Need. Yeah. So because we'd like to plan things that are sustainable or extend the work of others and really fit the needs of the community.
Okay. And so how would what you're planning be different from what you had with Arcadia? How much more would it add?
Yeah, I think that Arcadia was, even though it was a very rich program, it was very narrowly focused. So home health is highly regulated, and so that's why the licensing is really important. And without that license, we can't offer that same care. So how it's different, I'm really looking at a lot of the strengths in the programs that we have in our other areas. In Kalapapa, our Native Hawaiian arts with the residents of the care home, the Hansen Survivors, is really, really popular. Our behavior health services are really strong in both places. Whether it's something like help to quit smoking, or that it's something that is really difficult for families, sexual violence against children, suicide. If you look at our service areas, we lead the county in teen pregnancies, in suicide. More than 20 Native Hawaiian men in Molokai have killed themselves in the last 2 years. That's really high. Sexual violence against children is really high as well. So We have hired a Native Hawaiian psychologist that will be coming to Lana'i to offer services. Really just part of this question, too, what kind of services are needed, right?
It's really more holistic.
So I understand that for drug treatment, that people on Lana'i go to Maui for treatment, and then they come back to Lana'i and there's no certified substance abuse counselor. So our Molokai substance abuse counselor will come to Lana'i and try to meet with people to see what they need. Our La'au people are really active on Molokai, topside as well as in Kalaupapa. They do presentations. So to find out on Lana'i, who are your traditional practitioners?
You're looking at this as an opportunity to expand what was there.
Right. So some of the things that we've done really well, school-based program, behavior health programs, traditional healing programs, and just kind of identifying those gaps. And Lana'i is a really rich community. It's full of a wealth of information, really compassionate people, and just giving people an opportunity, I think, to be heard and help look at the future and help us design new things.
Okay, so the first thing you need, feedback.
Yes.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I really appreciate all the decade of support that we had from Arcadia, from Emmett White, from Judy Mikami, Billy Okudagawa, Dr. Emmett Aluli, Dr. Bill Thomas. There are so many people, Hardy Spohr, that really kind of set the foundation. And I think when things happen that really upset things that we know, it's difficult. But I think if we just kind of go back to our foundation and then just describe and create new things.
All right, and see where it goes.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for sitting down and talking with us.
Thank you.
That was Kamahana Hokulani Farrar, Executive Director of Napu'uwai, talking about a pilot project with John Hopkins School of Nursing. She says we'll get underway on Lana'i before the end of the year. We reached out to Arcadia Home Health Services, and President Emmett White says the company provided in-home care to some 40 kupuna on the island. It plans to provide a nurse and other staff to assist in the transition through the end of the year. Well, that wraps it up for today. Up tomorrow, how much is too much? Why a capacity study is about to get underway at Hanama Bay. Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talk back line and leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or HI Conversation on Twitter. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.